chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. Esther begins with the standard introduction that often begins the historical books of the Bible, indicating the author expects us to take these events as historical narrative of actual facts that happened. These events happened in the capital city of Susa, which was the winter capital for the Medo-Persian Empire. Susa was too hot in the summertime. Depending on your translation, the name of the king will either be Ahasuerus or Xerxes. And the manuscripts of Esther that are written in Hebrew all say Ahasuerus, as we see in the English Standard Version. The Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it gives the name Artaxerxes, often shortened to Xerxes. And it isn't really clear if Ahasuerus is a translation into Hebrew. Some theorize it was actually a mocking name. It sounds like headache, so King Headache maybe. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, became king when he was 32 years of age. I'm always amazed by these people who accomplish so much at such a young age. 32 years of age, he reigned for 20 years from 485 to 465 BC. His father was Darius, whose father was Cyrus the Great. During the beginning of Ahasuerus' reign, the Medo-Persian Empire was the greatest empire, the most powerful empire in the world. It stretched from northeastern Africa, Ethiopia, Egypt, across the entire Middle East, all the way over into India. And as the book of Esther begins, we have the third year of Ahasuerus' reign. His political and military leaders are coming up with a military strategy to attack their nemesis, Greece. Gathered are the elite of the military, the political powers, for a great war council. Ahasuerus' father, Darius, failed in his attempts to take Greece. They have a few years' rest, and now Ahasuerus is making plans to finally destroy Greece. That's what he's planning to do. They have this extended feast and strategy session. It lasts a half year, during which Ahasuerus shows off his vast wealth to all his allies. Remember, of course, his empire stretches across multiple tribes, peoples, bands, and something has to hold them together. And so Ahasuerus wants them to know that he has the wealth, he has the power to accomplish this military mission, to ensure victory. By the way, the war effort actually ends in dismal failure, but that's not relevant to our story. So we have a great king overseeing a war council, preparing for battle, verse 5. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict, there is no compulsion. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. So now that the war council has been completed, they have an additional feast for another 7 days in the capital of Susa. Again, the wealth of the king is emphasized. Linen and purple, gold and silver, marble pillars, precious stones. The drinks are served in glasses of gold. The best wine is available for all. And verse 8 tells us they could drink freely as much wine as they wanted. It is a feast for pleasure and joy. Perhaps a thanks to the people of Susa who had made this half-year-long feast possible, this war council. The interesting thing about the excessive description of this beauty, of this palace, is that Old Testament narratives are usually much more sparse with their words. The main other time that the Old Testament describes this kind of beauty is in the descriptions of the tabernacle and of the temple. And it kind of hits you with this reminder that this book in the Bible isn't set within the land of Israel. God had promised Israel that if they were faithful to his covenant, he would protect them and they would live in the land forever. Israel wasn't faithful. They worshipped other gods, other idols. And so God has brought judgment. The temple is destroyed. The land was ruined. The Israelites were cast out. They're brought into captivity in Babylon, which was then taken over by Persia, as we see here. Well, all those things happened about 100 years before these events we're reading. And so we should have this question in our minds: how will Israel, how will God's people fare under the control of this pagan empire? Well, verse 9 mentions Queen Vashti. The historian Herodotus records that Ahasuerus' wife was named Amistris. It isn't clear if Vashti is the same person. Perhaps Vashti is a nickname for Amistris. The name Vashti sounds like the Persian word for beautiful. So perhaps this was her nickname. It's also perhaps simply a second name that wasn't entirely uncommon. Or it's possible Amistris was a previous or later wife, where they were both wives at the same time. Multiple wives was very common. We'll call her Queen Vashti. She won't be around very long anyway. Verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zithar, Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. We've had 100 days of feasting and war planning, followed by a 7-day feast. The king has had plenty of wine, it says, and he asks his eunuchs to bring out Vashti, Queen Vashti, the beautiful, in order to display her beauty before the people and princes. Queen Vashti refuses. The king is infuriated. He's filled with rage. What has happened here, and why? A majority of commentators think that verse 11 provides the full list of things Queen Vashti was to wear before the crowd, namely her crown. Now, the king wants to display all her beauty to his guests so they know how truly blessed he is. If that interpretation is correct, then we could say Queen Vashti has done rightly in rejecting this immoral request. It would have been wrong for her to step out unclothed before this crowd of drunken men. No one has the right to demand something of your body that you don't want to do. And yet, the author of Esther does not defend Vashti's actions or motives. We have no evidence that she rejected this for moral reasons. She may have simply been tired, maybe simply angry at the king. Maybe she was rebellious. We do not know for sure why she refused to come. Well, Ahasuerus is angry because his authority has been defied. Here the king is setting up for a military expedition, solidifying the support of his military leaders, political allies, and he can't even get his own queen to obey him. All right, we're counting on this king to lead countless thousands, and he can't lead his own wife. Are we sure this is the man we want to follow? And so Ahasuerus is furious that his demands are not met. He is furious that his wife will not do his bidding. And it's amazing how things that seem so small can become so big. The king wants to go to war. He has a war council and a feast. The feast is wrapping up. He asks his wife to come out. She refuses. Very mundane, normal events of history. And yet, the rest of the story hinges on these events. Verse 13. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marsina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in the province of a King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household, and speak according to the language of his people. Well, the king's wife has defied him, and so he sets about to deal with it in the most natural way. He asks his political advisors how to respond. And this does highlight the political nature of the problem. The advisors offer up a political solution. But this problem is not just a marital problem at all now. The problem is that the king is not respected nor obeyed by his own queen. And so the king asks his advisors what is to be done. And they list out the seven advisors, and they're mentioned by name for the sake of historical record. These are historical events. Memucan is the one to speak up. Vashti has not sinned against the king alone. Oh, no. Vashti has sinned against all the peoples, against all the men of the empire. And now that Vashti has defied the king, all women will act in the same way toward their own husbands. Women just defying husbands all over the place. They will say, Vashti did it, and so can I. There will be contempt. There will be anger. But Memucan continues in verse 19, I have a solution. Let's set out a royal decree. Let's write a new law. Isn't that always the political solution? One more law, and we'll have it right. Vashti shall never again enter the king's presence. Her position shall be given to another who is better than she, namely, someone more submissive than she. Then, when all the women hear this decree, then they will honor and obey their husbands as they ought. The king and the other advisors love the plan. It's perfect. What could possibly go wrong? Women will honor their husbands by royal decree. You may notice in verse 19, Memucan says this law will be written according to the laws of the Persians and Medes, which cannot be revoked. There are a number of times the books of Daniel and Esther quote people who say that the laws of Persians and Medes can never be revoked. And it's interesting on a number of levels, but especially because almost every time it is said, the king later wishes to revoke said law and in fact does something to revoke it. I think probably there's a little biblical mockery of this empire which thought so much of its own law and yet had so little insight into the consequences of the laws they made. Well, before we move on to chapter 2, I think it's important to note how different the view of these men is from a biblical and God-honoring view of men and women. What we have here is nothing less than misogyny. It gets worse as we continue in the narrative. We have this all-male group that is so worried about the respect of women that they will make royal decrees to ensure that wives honor their husbands. We have a wife cast off because of perceived failure, the refusal to display her beauty. This is not how God calls husbands and wives to love each other. Right? The biblical view is that God made men and women equal. He gave us complementary roles. God does call husbands to lead their wives. God does call wives to submit to their husbands. But God calls us to do that in this way. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Wives, submit to your husbands as to Christ. A husband has no right to demand appearance as Ahasuerus has demanded. The proper place to deal with marital issues is not through royal decrees, but through loving care and loving concern. Because of one act, which actually probably was right defiance by Vashti, she will be banished forever from the king's presence, never to see him again. This is not the kind of loving self-sacrifice God calls husbands to maintain. I wonder, though, husbands, if we're often maybe not so different from the king here. So upset that our whims are not met, wondering why the food isn't ready, angry that the house is messy, never mind we contributed to the mess, frustrated about why the children are being disciplined in a certain way, and yet forgetting that our wives are the ones who spend most of the time with our children so often, using our leadership for our own service rather than to serve our wives. The counsel of the king here is not designed to give you a good example of godly leadership. This is failed leadership. Well, isn't it ironic how so often we let our fears control us, and we actually ensure that our fears become reality? The king and his advisors are so worried that people will know that the king was not honored by his queen, that they proclaim a royal decree that will be announced to the end of the kingdom, and the royal decree says this: the king was not honored by the queen. He ensures everybody knows. One thing we see here is that wealth does not produce wisdom. The king of Persia has all wealth, all power, and we find he is a petty fool. His laws aren't about carrying out justice, but demanding respect. Wealth doesn't create wisdom. Prudence doesn't come from power. They think respect can be accomplished by decree. Husbands, if you think you'll get your wife to respect you by demanding it, you're as foolish as the king and his counselors. This first chapter ends with suspense. Vashti is being replaced. We're left to wonder who will replace her. Chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the citadel. Under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Remember how the law cannot be revoked? Well, suddenly, now that his anger is over, he remembers Vashti and how it was really nice to be married to a beautiful woman, and now she can't even be in his presence. You know, anger does that to us, though. It makes us make foolish decisions, harmful decisions. The advisors got the king into this mess, and so the advisors are going to have to get him out of the mess, right? If the king isn't happy, nobody's happy. So they better come up with a new plan, better advice. No problem. We'll have a beauty contest. We'll gather all the most beautiful virgins from throughout the empire. Whichever can please the king can become queen instead of Vashti. Now, Ahasuerus clearly has an appreciation for beautiful things, including beautiful things like women. And that seems to be how he views them, as things to be enjoyed. Do you see how sinful choices often produce further sinful choices? Our sin isn't just an event with a stop and an end. Sin is a journey down a path that you may not see the end of, which will take you farther than you ever thought possible. Verse 5, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 young chosen women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. For the first time in our narrative, the Jews are mentioned. Mordecai and his younger cousin Esther, who was orphaned. Mordecai had adopted his cousin and raised her. We need some more history at this point to really understand the situation. I mentioned Israel had been exiled due to disobedience to God. In 586 BC, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, he sacked Jerusalem, he destroyed the temple, he carried off all the captives to Babylon, including Jeconiah, the king of Judah. Now, if verse 6 is saying Mordecai was one of those captives, which is possible, that would make him over 100 years old at this time, which would be exceptionally rare in that day. On the other hand, verse 6 may just be identifying Mordecai with that deportation. This is how he came to be in Susa, because of that deportation, because the Jews were deported. And all of this, again, is because of Israel's covenant unfaithfulness to God. God allowed the pagan kingdoms to crush them. Things improved, though. Cyrus the Great, grandfather of Ahasuerus, he decreed in 539 BC that all Jews could return to Jerusalem, resettle there, and then rebuild the temple. Read about those events in the biblical books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Faithful Jews did return to the homeland, but a lot of Jews had found new lives in the empire. They didn't want to go back. They had good professions. They didn't return. And that's how we find Mordecai and Esther in the capital city of Susa. Not in Jerusalem, where the faithful Jews were, but living among the Gentiles. We're told that Esther is an orphan and that she is beautiful. And her beauty, as mentioned so quickly, indicates it's important to our story. Remember that beautiful Vashti will be replaced by a beautiful virgin. For the sake of our story, beauty is Esther's most important trait. And now, because of the king's rash anger, his foolish decrees, Esther is brought into the royal harem. Because of her beauty, Esther is moved up to a place of prominence in the harem. And notice this in verse 10. Esther has hidden the fact that she is a Jew. At Mordecai's request, Esther has not shared that she's a Jew. And again, we see the unfaithfulness of Mordecai and Esther. They haven't returned to Jerusalem with the faithful Jews. Apparently, they have so adapted to the attire and the habits of the Persians, they fit right in. They're entirely unrecognizable as the people of God. Whereas, like in the book of Daniel, we see Daniel and his friends announcing their heritage, refusing to eat the king's food. Esther is in the king's harem, hiding her identity. Mordecai is asking her to conceal who she really is, or at least who she is supposed to really be. These actions set Mordecai and Esther apart from other biblical characters who willingly risk death rather than sacrifice their principles. I mentioned we often like to sort of whitewash the biblical narratives, make them very tame and innocent. And the next few verses make it clear that although beauty was the first requirement to participate in the king's wife contest, that wasn't just a beauty pageant. Verse 12, now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. When the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shazgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So the women went through 12 months, a full year of beautification. The best possible skin moisturizers, exfoliators, perfumes, spices, curlers, straighteners, everything a woman could want for beauty. More specifically, everything the king could want for his women for their beauty. These women prepared for 12 months to be perfectly beautiful for one night in the king's bedroom. Before they went in with the king, they stayed in the virgin's quarters, in the virgin's harem. Then they spent with the night with the king. And of course, then they couldn't go back to the virgin's harem. They had to go to the other harem where the concubine stayed. Each woman had one night to please the king. And then she would never see the king again unless he enjoyed her and called her by name. And let's read about Esther's turn and then we'll make some comments on that whole situation. Verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. It's fairly simple, really. Esther follows the advice of the king's eunuch and takes only what he recommends. He probably knows what the king likes. This is wise counsel. Esther, in her one night with the king, pleases the king more than all the other virgins did, and so he makes her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king throws a great feast to honor Esther as the new queen. I'd like just to take a moment for us to consider the sins involved that led to this point. Think about the advisors to the king here. What they've proposed to the king is morally disturbing. Of course, they recommended he banish his first wife simply for refusing to obey a bad command. Then they recommend that he makes objects out of countless women and use them however he desired until he found one good enough for him. This is the kind of advice our world gives to men today, right? Go have a good time, test things out, have a sexual relationship with whomever you want. Of course, the king should have rejected this advice, right? He's the king. He makes the law. He can't just pass the buck and said, well, my counselor said this was a good idea. He's the one who chose to sleep with countless women. There were nothing more to him than objects to satisfy his desires. What an abuse of power and authority. What a mockery of what marriage is supposed to be. Now, these men are all pagans, though. Like, we understand, sort of. Not that I'm justifying them. I'm just saying you can understand they don't have the law, right? They know God. We talked about this earlier in Sunday school. But now we get to Mordecai. Mordecai is a Jew. He knows the law. What kind of a man is Mordecai to allow such a thing to happen to his cousin? Right? To encourage her, to hide her identity, to help her be chosen. I would hope no man in this room would allow your daughter, someone you knew, to participate. Right? Not as long as you're alive anyway. Right? There is another choice here. And that brings us to Esther, and we have to talk about her sin to participate. I think we can allow some element that Esther was forced into this, right? She didn't just jump at this necessarily, but the text doesn't indicate she would have been punished for refusing. In fact, her actions suggest not someone fighting for purity, but someone willing to do whatever it takes to become queen. Someone willing to be better with the king than any of the other virgins were able to be. She allowed a man that she knew was not a believer to test out marital love prior to marriage. She willingly entered into marriage with an unbeliever who had known other partners. The harems didn't disappear. Esther is not a model of virtue. And I think we have to wonder if Mordecai and Esther's pattern of fitting in with the world became much more comfortable than the alternative. If they loved the pleasures of this world more than faithfulness to God. And now they have what they want. Esther is the queen, but at what cost? And maybe you find yourself like Mordecai and Esther. you do fit in with this world. You enjoy all the things this world has to offer, and maybe sometimes you find that the line between general enjoyment and total immersion becomes a little blurry. Or do you find that your interests are not just similar to, but actually exactly the same as the unbeliever that you work with or who lives next to you? Maybe you enjoy having a fantasy sports team. There's nothing wrong with that. But then again, maybe you've gotten so consumed by fantasy sports that you're running analytics and stats to ensure you have the best fantasy sports team, and other areas of your life are totally falling apart. You've become obsessed by winning, and your family's wondering why you don't have any time for them. Maybe it isn't fantasy sports, but real sports or politics, business, leisure activities, golf. It could be anything. Maybe your love for a particular thing has become more central than your love for God. We have to always ask ourselves if our thoughts and our actions are really consistent with service to God. The Apostle John tells us, do not love the world or the things of the world. And yet we're so often very pleased with the world. It's easy to pick on King Ahasuerus with his vast wealth, his vast abuse of women. But men, do you do the same thing on a more personal level? Are you like these men, using women to fulfill your own lusts? Do you demand more of a woman than God has given to you? Maybe not even physically. Maybe do you watch movies or explicit photos or provocative videos that cause women the same kind of harm? Right, our world actually takes this exact same kind of abuse on women and puts it on videos on the internet. And men around the world support it. Women, are you ever like Esther, willing to use your allure and attractiveness to get what you want? Maybe willing to give a man what he wants in order to ensure you catch him, maybe using your body in the workplace to move up in advance? Friend, we are made in the image of God. And we are called to demonstrate the glory of God in what we do with our bodies. Here's the amazing thing about the characters in our story. They're not models of noble faithfulness. They're broken, messed up people, much like you and me. And the amazing thing that we'll see is that God uses them anyway. God redeems them anyway. God isn't looking for a few good men to help him accomplish his purposes. God is looking for a few broken, helpless, incompetent people. And God will demonstrate the glory of his grace and his power by using those imperfect people to accomplish his perfect eternal plan. If you read through Esther looking for human heroes, we're not off to a very good start, are we? But behind the scenes, there is a greater hero who is always moving history according to his perfect purpose and plan. And no sin stands in his way. No evil purpose thwarts his just and righteous purposes. If you find yourself too much like Esther, or too much like Mordecai, or even too much like Ahasuerus and his advisors, God can still use you. You haven't gotten too far away from God's will. You haven't kept God from acting. God has you exactly where he wants you to accomplish his purposes. But what God does call you to is repentance. One thing Esther's life ensures is that God's people endure. God uses Esther to maintain the line of Abraham, to ensure the birth of the one that God had promised Abraham would bring blessing to all nations of the earth. Many years later, from the offspring of Abraham, from the tribe of Judah, a son of David will be born as that promised offspring. A promised offspring is Jesus himself, who died for sinners like me and like you. He's the one who is the perfect king, and unlike Esther's king, all his acts are justice. He is the perfect Israelite, and unlike the Israelites in our story, he always kept the covenant. He is the perfect son, and unlike the sons of Abraham in our story, he always obeyed his father. And thus Jesus is qualified to stand in our place as our righteous substitute. Jesus paid the price for sin for everyone who trusts in him. And God calls us, you and me, to abandon our sin and to trust in his Son. You are not too broken for God to forgive you. You're not too sinful, too evil. You've not moved beyond God's plan for you. But if you see that you're not obeying God's law, if you see that you're not obeying him, now is the time to return and be faithful. Let's continue in verse 19. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther. And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. It isn't clear why the virgins have gathered a second time, perhaps simply to announce that Esther is ascending to the throne. Esther is still keeping her people unknown, as per Mordecai's instructions. When it says Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, that means he was a government official. That's where they did the official business, at the entrance of the city. And it just so happened that two eunuchs became angry at the king and sought to kill him. And it just so happened that Mordecai overheard of the plot. And so it just so happened that his cousin was the queen, and so he told Queen Esther, who told the king in Mordecai's name. The king investigated the matter, found these things were true. He had these men executed. Mordecai's heroism is recorded in the book of records. So we still have Mordecai and Esther, and they're not being faithful, and yet God is using them. Mordecai saves the king's life, and so does Esther. Their status is raised in the king's eyes. And yet, although Mordecai's act is written down, he receives no praise, no advancement for it. There's no reward for his actions. Isn't that so often the case, that we don't see ourselves receiving credit for things that we think we've accomplished? But God sees, and God knows, and God is working all things out at the proper time. As chapter 2 ends, Jewish Esther has become queen. Mordecai has saved the king, and this act is written down, but he receives no reward. But so far, it's hard to see how this narrative affects the people of God. In chapter 3, which we'll look at beginning next week, the story takes a twist. As we close, consider the providence of God. God is far greater than our mind can even begin to fathom. He's working in all the events of history. He's working in the great events of history, and he's working in the tiny moments of our lives. Those moments when it seems like nothing good could come from this, God is in control of those times too. God is working out his purposes. Consider this powerful king making unreasonable demands of his wife, furious at her refusal to obey him. He casts her aside, then he wishes he had a beautiful queen after all. He's abusing his authority to enjoy countless women. Consider these advisors concerned about their own position and power, fearful lest their own wives fail to respect them, manipulating the kings to their own end, not concerned about justice or righteousness. None of them are thinking about God or his plan, his design. Consider Esther, an orphan raised by an apparently manipulative, calculating cousin. Certainly no expectation of royal position or privilege. Brought into the queen's harem, now made the queen. From the decrees of kings, to the foolish demands of kings, to the heritage of a young lady kept secret, God is in control. We often think we're in control of our lives, right? So long as we plan everything out, we work out all the details, we think we can ensure our success. But that really isn't the case at all, is it? Our control is a mere illusion. God is in control. God carries out his purposes. It is God's counsel that will stand. You know, we interpret our lives through our own tiny little lens, deciding if an event is good or bad, deciding if this event should result in praise to God or questioning God. And yet God is behind all the events of life. God is using even those events that we would not choose for ourselves. I doubt anyone in San Antonio was praying for hail to come last week. And yet there it happened, millions, maybe billions of dollars in damage. And yet God was in it. Apparently we didn't need that money anyway. What we do need is to trust God. We're like a three-year-old working on a jigsaw puzzle. Have you ever seen a three-year-old working on a jigsaw puzzle and they have the wrong piece in the wrong place? Or they have the right piece, but it's upside down. And you try to help them, and they won't let you. This piece goes here. And that's us. We think we know what should happen. We think we see the big picture. And the God who made the puzzle is telling us there's a better way. And we don't always believe him. So rather than question God's plan, we should trust him. The name of God may not be in Esther, but his finger is. God is always at work. Sometimes in the big public acts of history, like God rescuing Israel from Egypt, but more often, God is at work, as it were, behind the scenes, invisible. The most mundane events of life, God is working. And God is always working in every moment for his glory and for the good of his people. They say that large doors swing on small hinges. The events of history swing on small events. God is at work. We see here in these first chapters of Esther that God prepares the way. We don't know yet in the narrative why Esther has been made queen, but God knows. When you do not understand what God is doing in your life, just know that he is working for his glory and for your good, for all those who love him. Friends, if we really grasped the providence of God, it would transform the way we live and the way we think. Right? No more fear of what will happen next in our life. No more doubt that this bad event in life has a good purpose. But knowing that every single thing that happens, happens at God's command. And trusting that God really only acts for his glory and for our good. So we are always safe in his hands. Let's pray together.